couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. There's only one new movie on today's show, and that is The Lion King, the remake from Disney. But I've been inspired after watching Stranger Things the other week to do some retro reviews of the movies that were in the Stranger Things Cineplex at Starcourt. So we'll be talking about The Wizard of Oz, Return to Oz, and Day of the Dead. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Space 1999, the complete series on Blu-ray, and Shazam. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news is one that's been cycling. It's been kind of resurrecting over and over and over again, and now that we've got Comic-Con going on this week, the question has been, what about Quentin Tarantino in his Star Trek movies? And he's, because apparently the story goes, he had done a pitch to J.J. Abrams for a Star Trek movie. And Abrams like, yeah, get it written, do a script, and we'll get it done. I don't know what Paramount's doing right now when it comes to Star Trek, because that Star Trek Beyond kind of flopped, and I don't know what they're trying to do on the big screen, because you've got Star Trek Discovery happening on the small screen. You've also got the Picard series that's coming to, I don't know what streaming service, I don't even remember what streaming service that is. So you've got all this stuff out there, and one thing that Paramount does want to do is it wants to streamline its stuff and make it all consistent. But still, I don't think this is going to happen. If you think Quentin Tarantino's actually going to get off his duff and do a Star Trek movie, you're foolish. Also, he's not going to have the patience to do the big budget special effects. He's never done that kind of a movie. That guy literally has as many films he's said he's going to make and abandoned than he has actually made. And so, yeah, he did Kill Bill. Yeah, he did The Hateful Eight. But he never did that Vega Brothers movie. And he never did the Django Inglourious Basterds mashup movie. I mean, there's so much stuff he hasn't done. So I'm not holding my breath for Quentin Tarantino's Star Trek movie. The other piece that is happening, a movie that is being made, is Bond 25. And they had a couple casting notices come out this week. The first one being that Blofeld is returning, played by Christoph Waltz, which I think is good because I like having Blofeld as a foil to James Bond. The problem I have with the Blofeld they put in Spectre and how they put it into this new timeline, they've made it too personal. Blofeld worked as just an evil dude running this insane multinational place of terror and extortion and revenge. It was corny, silly, Cold War stuff, and I liked that. This makes it a little bit too much, and that's the problem, is you develop James Bond too much and you don't have a good character. He's a sociopath, really. He's a psychopath in a lot of ways. He separates his feelings from his job and he murders people for a living. You don't want to get in that guy's head. Now, the other piece of casting news that came out about James Bond is actually a bit of trolling by the people at Eon Productions. They let the news leak that there's a new 007. And not only is there a new 007, the new 007 is going to be played by Lashana Lynch, who, if you don't know who that is, she was the other fighter pilot in Captain Marvel, you know, the one that Carol Danvers was friends with, the African-American woman who had a daughter that she got to know, and they went to their house in the country and everything. She's a British actor. She just didn't play a Brit in this movie, but she's already a known cast member of the new Bond 25, but they're like, oh, she's the new 007, which immediately, you put that release out there, immediately everyone's like, oh my gosh, I got a black female James Bond. Nope. Put on the brakes. You were just gamed and trolled by Eon Productions. The story, we already know the plot, at least the beginning plot of Bond 25, and it's that he quit to go get married, and then he's pulled back into everything. We can assume his wife's going to get killed. We can assume that it's something personal, and we can assume that because he gave up the 007 moniker, that MI6 gave that number to somebody else. They only have 10 of those numbers, and maybe only 9. Do they have a 000? I don't know. But so if you're assuming there's 9 great operatives out there from British intelligence, that once one of them leaves, they give the number to somebody else. They wouldn't just run around with 8. So she's basically playing his replacement. And you can pretty much guess that, this is my prediction, they're going to work together, they're going to sleep together, and she's probably going to get killed like every other female agent in any of these Bond movies, and then he's going to go back to being 007, and then they're going to recast it and then have everyone freak out again on the internet. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Two early Comic-Con trailers that have dropped this week. There's a whole bunch that are coming out this weekend because Comic-Con goes all the way through Sunday, even though nothing happens on Sunday. But I'm not going to be doing up-to-the-minute stuff. Let's just do these really early trailers that drop. The first one is Top Gun Maverick, which opens next summer on June 26th.
You should be at least a two-star admiral by now. Yet here you are. Captain. Why is that?
It's one of life's mysteries, sir.
The end is inevitable, Maverick. Your kind is headed for extinction.
Maybe so, sir. But not today.
It's kind of an unfair trailer to play because most of the trailer is the flying shots and him riding a motorcycle. These are the two little bits of dialogue. Otherwise, all you're going to be hearing is music and jets flying around. There's no sense of story whatsoever to this, which I guess is okay because the original Top Gun didn't have much of a story to begin with. I'm not a fan. I am not a fan of the original Top Gun. And this one looks like what it's going to hinge on is the flying sequences, the look of the film. It's going to be the go to the big screen, go to see it on a large format screen so you can watch these jets in the air. I don't know whether it's going to be a decent story. It feels like they're just kind of taking the Ethan Hunt character and throwing him in there. But like I said, we get no sense of story, character, plot, or anything from this. It just looks like it's going to have some really cool big screen moments. The next one I want to hit really quickly is Jay and Silent Bob Reboot, which opens on October 15th.
Identify yourselves!
I'm Jay, and this my head-on life mate, Silent Bob!
Don't tell me you guys have no idea there's a new comic book movie being made of the old comic book movie you two are the basis for.
That movie sucked. We got 3 days to get to Hollywood and stop this reboot from ever happening.
Boys, I had a baby.
Jay, brace yourself. You're about to meet our love child.
This is my daughter, Millennium Falcon.
This is the latest Kevin Smith movie. This is the latest of him going back to the well, back to the Jay and Silent Bob characters. It's essentially them going back and redoing, retreading the Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back movie. The problem is this doesn't look funny at all. And it also looks kind of depressing. Jay and Silent Bob look so old. And of course, because they are. Jay's 45 and Silent Bob's 48. At least that's the age of the actors in there. And then they went ahead and cast Kevin Smith's daughter again, who can't act at all. Her entire film career is nothing but your own movies, Kevin Smith. She's the Ivanka Trump of the Viewisk universe. The only reason she's got a job is because she's related to the boss. And then on top of it, you know, Jay and Silent Bob, he's been doing this character for so long, it gets pathetic when it's in your 40s. You're almost 50. Do something different. And if you look at his trajectory of his films, I mean, he started out doing some interesting stuff. You know, he did Clerks and Mallrats, and he did personal stuff like Chasing Amy and even Jersey Girl. I'll give him credit for Jersey Girl. That was a personal project. But then he made Zack and Mary Made a Porno, and he ramped up his pot smoking to 11. And if you look at it after Zack and Mary, Cop Out, which was terrible, Red State, which was okay, and then Tusk, which kind of went completely bonkers in the middle, Yoga Hosers, which was god-awful, Holidays, which he just did a segment of, which is terrible, and then Jay and Silent Bob Reboot. It's just, if you've ever needed any sort of proof of why you shouldn't do drugs in a chronic manner, it is Kevin Smith's career, how it saps creativity and intelligence and quality and art. And on top of it, he's four-walling this thing, so he's not even doesn't even have the guts to put it out there as a regular movie. So I don't even know why I keep covering him. Anyways, that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the Oz films, Wizard of Oz and Return to Oz.
I could while away the hours, conferring with the flowers, consulting with the rain. in my head. I'd be scratching while my thoughts were busy hatching if I only had a brain.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews. The first one I want to hit is The Wizard of Oz. Now, I know that The Wizard of Oz was not in Stranger Things Season 3. But in order to watch Return to Oz, which was in Stranger Things, I wanted to go back and look at The Wizard of Oz. Plus, I was watching with my son. He's 11. He had never seen The Wizard of Oz, which is I just hadn't shown it to him. And which is odd because when I was a kid, it aired every year. It was a big deal to catch it on television. Well, I showed him Wizard of Oz this past weekend because I wanted him to have that, at least that background, so he could watch Return to Oz, not just to get the context of it and the sort of cinema history behind it, but also to see how much those two movies differ. So in the movie, a girl from Kansas is transported by a tornado into a marvelous land of Oz where she meets new friends and must battle a wicked witch.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
It lands in theaters everywhere.
See the wizards, the wonderful wizard of Oz.
For the first time, digitally restored.
These things must be done delicately.
And remastered in digital stereo sound.
Well, that makes a difference.
Because. I am.
Follow the yellow brick road.
Follow the yellow brick road.
I apologize for that idiot narrator in that trailer. The trailer's not bad. It's, oh, follow the yellow brick road. Remember how they used to always have a voiceover in trailers? Now they just put words on the screen. But in this one, he's like, and all the friends and the fun of Oz, the music is back. And I'm like, shut up. But here's the thing. The Wizard of Oz is groundbreaking. It's one of those movies that it's hard to realize that movie is 80 years old. This year, Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind. And Gone with the Wind is to be respected on its own, but Wizard of Oz, there's something more about Wizard of Oz. Gone with the Wind was epic and sweeping and blah, 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 and all beautiful and shot in Technicolor, et cetera, et cetera. Wizard of Oz had the effects. And that's important because we're talking 1939. Once you got into the 70s, once you kind of got post 2001, Space Odyssey, into the early 70s, you know, special effects were to be expected, but I mean, 30 years before that, Wizard of Oz was achieving some amazing things. And yeah, some of it breaks down. Obviously, some of it breaks down. The background sometimes break down. You can tell things are sets. But gosh, just the twister itself, it's a sock, but it's done so effectively. And it drastically deviates from the books. I haven't read all the Oz books, but I've read the first five or six or seven when I was younger of the L. Frank Baum books. And it deviates from that quite a bit. And a lot of it was studio meddling, but it's one of those times where studio meddling kind of made a beautiful movie. The whole, it was all a dream. That was put in because at the time, 1939, when movies were still a relatively young mass market medium, they didn't know if people would get it being a fantasy at that level. So that's why they made it. It was all a dream at the end. Oh, spoiler alert. If you've never seen The Wizard of Oz, I just told the ending of The Wizard of Oz. But this movie is opulent and gorgeous. And yeah, there's some weird things. And yeah, they do kind of marginalize the munchkins and all. But I've got the Blu-ray of it, and it looks absolutely fantastic. The color depth is amazing, and the makeup is fabulous in this. And you got to realize, this is back when, you know, they were putting on cheesy prosthetic noses. This is back at a time where they just didn't have the makeup technology, but they really did a good job with it. And the music is wonderful, and even though it deviates far from the book, it's a charming one, except for the I Was a King of a Forest song, which I've never liked. But overall, the movie just moves and it works, and it's one of my favorite movies of all time because of how important and iconic it is in American cinema. So I'm going to say, obviously, Wizard of Oz totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Now let's go back to 1985 and go to the Starcourt Mall and check out Return to Oz, which is playing alongside all the other stuff during the 4th of July celebration in Hawkins, Indiana. Stranger Things, Season 3. In Return to Oz, still suffering from psychosis following the devastating tornado, Dorothy finds herself pulled back to Oz to stop the Gnome King from taking over the land.
It's just a yellow brick.
No, Belina, you don't understand. This was the Yellow Brick Road.
You share with Dorothy Gale
The shock of finding everything mysteriously changed.
What's happened to everybody?
And you'll delight with her discovery of four wonderful new friends who band together against a wicked queen and the dreaded Gnome King.
Why don't we just fly back to Kansas?
I remember when this movie came out, because I saw it, and I've said before, I am the same age as the kids in the Stranger Things movie. One of the reasons that connects with me so well is because I was like 14 at the time, 13, 14 years old in the summer of 1985. So I was the age of these kids. I mean, we didn't have Demodogs and the Mind Flayer or anything else ripping up my hometown, but I was in that mindset of pop culture. And I remember seeing Return to Oz with my family and absolutely loving it, partly because it's so much darker than the original Wizard of Oz. It's creepy. And in fact, years ago, we showed it to my two oldest sons, and they were little. I mean, they were like maybe 5 and 7 at the time than when I showed it to them. And they almost made us turn it off because the opening scenes, the early moments before they even get to Oz, kind of freaks them out because Dorothy's in this insane asylum and you've got the characters that are going to be giving her like electroshock therapy, because this, of course, takes place in the turn of the century, the turn of the 19th to 20th century. The other reason I love this movie so much is how authentically it feels like the L. Frank Baum books. It captures that more than anything else I've ever seen that's been made of Oz. And there's been a ton of things, everything from Oz the Great and Powerful from a couple years ago to that Tin Man show on Sci-Fi. This really feels like Oz. And it's before digital effects, so everything's, like you can actually grab it and hold it. And it was, they used the Henson Creature Shop to do like Jack Pumpkinhead. You also had them do the Gnome King, which had certain degrees of animation and puppetry, but it mixed it really well. And it's sort of like the mid-80s of Muppet technology that really made this thing come to authentic life. And it's an amalgamation of The Land of Oz and Ozma of Oz, these two books, and they kind of cram them together. And so they do make some changes, but they go to all the way back to the design. TikTok looks like he did in the books. The Tin Man and the Scarecrow look like they did in the books. They don't look like Ray Bolger and Jack Haley. It looks great. And then you've got Fairuza Balk in one of her first roles. I think it might be her first role, doing a spot-on Judy Garland accent for Dorothy, but she looks like Dorothy from the books. You know, she's like 8 years old, she's got pigtails, and she's got that little gingham dress. But the big thing is she's a child, as opposed to, you know, being, 16 or 17 when Judy Garland made the original Wizard of Oz. This movie is different. It's exciting. It's got a great adventure. It's got beautiful special effects, and it can be a little bit unnerving. It's one of those movies that you get from the 80s or the 70s that's meant for kids, but you watch it and go, this is creepy. This is some disturbing stuff. It was at a time when they weren't handling kids with kids' gloves. No pun intended. They said, okay, there are some real scary things that can happen in the world, and we're just representing that in this weird fantasy environment. So yeah, absolutely. Return to Oz, if you've never seen it, it is absolutely one you should check out for no other reason than to just see an authentic L. Frank Baum inspired Oz movie. Return to Oz totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Lion King and Day of the Dead. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into more movie reviews with the new film of the weekend, and that is The Lion King. Jon Favreau directs this photorealistic CGI remake of the 1994 animated classic about a young lion who leaves his pride when he is convinced he's killed his father.
Everything you see exists together in a delicate balance. While others search for what they can take, a true king searches for what he can give. You must take your place in the circle of life.
What's funny with The Lion King is that when it came out in 1994, it was not my favorite Disney movie. I in fact, thought it was a huge letdown from Aladdin, because Aladdin had preceded it. From Little Mermaid to Beauty and the Beast to Aladdin, it was just, to me, 100% A-plus quality for those three movies. And The Lion King is okay, but I never loved it. And that's because I was in my early 20s when it came out. So, I mean, if I were six, it probably would have been the greatest movie of all time. And I appreciated it. And over the years, I learned to appreciate it. And then after 1994, you know, it played a lot on VHS. And in the early 2000s, they put it into IMAX. And then I started doing DVD reviews, and I got The Lion King on disc, and my kids were really little at the time, and so they watched The Lion King like anybody else did, just watched it ad nauseum forever and ever and ever. And I did realize that the movie does hold up. And what makes it work is the same thing that kind of like when I was originally not a fan of Finding Nemo, part of the reason that I turned on that movie and this one as well into liking it is because its rewatchability was there. And yeah, you could get tired of any movie, but there's a big difference between having to watch The Lion King every day or watching Finding Nemo every day and having to watch episodes and episodes of JoJo Circus or Bob the Builder, which makes you want to pull your hair out. That's why I'm bald right now. But the original Lion King, as big of a hit as that was, I still didn't consider it better or as good as it's the preceding three movies. Now, when Disney has been remaking these movies, and I have been very critical of certain ones, and as you know, I was incredibly critical of Aladdin and Beauty and the Beast. Both of those, I'm like, those are kind of unnecessary because there's a purity to the original, and all you're just doing is just kind of reshooting it, and then you're adding stuff that doesn't work. Now, when Jon Favreau did The Jungle Book, I really enjoyed that. Part of that is because the original Jungle Book is this hodgepodge of stories, and they made a better through line, and by making it photorealistic, it took it out of that sort of rustic look of the 60s animation that they had from the Walt Disney era, and they made it a much slicker, very different movie. So there's a huge difference between the original Jungle Book and the remake. This one is absolutely just a reshoot or reimagining. I don't want to say reshoot because I don't think they used a single camera in this production. I'm sure they used cameras, but there's not a single, I don't think there's any photographed frame anywhere from this movie. This is all developed in a computer, which is kind of fascinating on its own because it looks authentic. I would say this is probably the most authentic looking a realistic movie. And the reason this is so hard to achieve as opposed to something like Avatar, where you got dragons and Navi and different people. We know what a lion looks like. You can go to a zoo and see lions walking around. You can watch nature documentary videos online or National Geographic shows. And you know how lions and elephants and warthogs and meerkats, you know how they move, and we're familiar with that. And they're able to achieve a real look to it. And that's kind of fascinating. And yes, is this movie unnecessary? Sure, you're right. It's unnecessary. You don't need this movie. But I think it kind of hits a sweet spot in nostalgia. I mean, this movie's, what, 25 years since the original came out? Kids that were little kids who grew up with this are going to go want to see this when they're adults because they're, what, like 30 now, and they have kids of their own that they're going to take. So it's got that same tapping into nostalgia that Finding Dory had or that The Incredibles had when they made Incredibles 2. And that's why I think this one's going to click. And it's funny because a lot of critics out there are just ripping this movie apart because they're like, oh, it's unnecessary. Yeah, it's unnecessary, but it's still kind of cool to watch. It's kind of an amazing movie. And in that sense, because it is something different, my view is if you're going to remake a movie, you got to bring something new to the table. You either have to have a new technology that allows you to do something, or you're going to change it to make it more authentic or make it to the book. Like when John Carpenter remade The Thing from Another World, he said, I'm going to go back to the original story that John W. Campbell wrote. And so in that sense, the remake was actually kind of better, as opposed to when they remade Psycho. And they just said, we're just going to reshoot this with a different cast, which was unnecessary and kind of silly at that point. But there absolutely is technology that was unavailable at the time. And you can sit there and say, well, they don't have the expressive faces. But it literally looks like they trained lions and warthogs and meerkats and elephants to do this movie. And that's fascinating to watch. If you love that original movie and you've seen it a billion times, it's neat to watch it in a different version with a different voice cast, with the exception of James Earl Jones. So I'm going to have to say The Lion King kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews with Day of the Dead. Again, another movie that is shown in Stranger Things Season 3. In fact, if you remember in the first episode, they sneak into the theater to watch an early screening of Day of the Dead. In George Romero's third zombie film, a smattering of survivors live in an underground bunker where scientists and military men butt heads.
First came the night, then came the dawn. Now comes the most eagerly awaited day in horror film history. George A. Romero's Day of the Dead.
We've been punished by the Creator. He visited a curse.
For the few remaining, their only hope of survival is to find a cure.
You're wasting time trying to define what's happening.
But the odds are against them. But when the tricks wouldn't work, their world fell apart.
I remember the summer of 1985. This came out, and also Return of the Living Dead came out. I remember seeing an article in the paper that said the Summer of the Dead, because they had these two zombie movies that were Living Dead zombie movies. And I was a little young. I was like 13. And my parents weren't letting me watch. We didn't have HBO, and we could rent videos, but you have to have a parent to rent the videos, and they weren't letting me watch Dawn of the Dead at that age. I tried to actually go see Return of the Living Dead with a friend, and God bless him, he couldn't lie enough. He said he was 15 instead of 17, so he still couldn't get in. And I'm like, Mike, you didn't even lie right. So I was a big horror fan, and I kind of wanted to see this. It took me years to see it. I had to wait until I got old enough to watch it on video. And this was back the time when Romero doing a dead movie was something special, because this was only the third one he did. When he did Land of the Dead in the early 2000s and then just came out with one right after the other, and he just continued, and it was going direct-to-video stuff and smaller productions. When he's doing like Diary of the Dead and Survival of the Dead, it lost its novelty. Not to mention the fact that we were in the land of the Walking Dead, where everybody was doing zombie movies. But this is when zombie movies were still kind of unique. It's extremely graphic, and it's not my favorite of the dead movies. I think over the years, I will always say Night of the Living Dead is my favorite, and I kind of hold this and Dawn of the Dead on equal footing, because I know there's a lot of love out there for Dawn of the Dead, but I still think there's some silliness. I like the authentic violent feel to it. The graphic violence looks so much more realistic than that red paint blood and the purple zombie faces that they have in Dawn of the Dead. This one I think is really interesting because it's a commentary on the military industrial complex. That's how Romero's always had framed his movies. He's trying to say something about a group in society, and it's showing, you know, kind of at the end of Days how they interact with each other. And I think that message holds, as well as the consumerism message that he has in Dawn of the Dead. But Day of the Dead's a little more simple of a movie. It's a little more contained because it has such a small cast, you know, in a more remote area. But still, Day of the Dead is a significant movie in zombie lore and significant in horror movies. And I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the box office and the home cinema roundup featuring Space 1999, the complete series, and Shazam. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Now that we've done the movie reviews and looked at some retro reviews from 1985, inspired by Stranger Things Season 3, I've also bought the box of New Coke from Stranger Things, from Coca-Cola, and it's expensive. I mean, it works out to be about $7 or $8 a can of the New Coke, but I wanted to try it because I remember when New Coke was first introduced in 1985, and then of course I remember what a disaster it was for Coke, but they kept that around until like the early 90s and they called it like Coke 2 or something like that, but it's been gone for almost 30 years. But I wanted to actually get a couple cans and I wanted to have a little taste test with my kids and say, okay, this is Coke, this is Pepsi, this is New Coke. Tell me what you think. Because I remember doing that back in the 80s. It's kind of fun. It was worth a little bit of money. And we got a couple Stranger Things bottles and memorabilia. But still, it's expensive soda. But this goes right to the sweet spot of my childhood. But right now, let's talk about the box office. And last week, the box office, it wasn't exactly a stellar week for the box office. The new movies were Crawl and Stuber, and those did okay. I think they played essentially to expectations, maybe a little bit lower for Stuber, but it was $12 million for Crawl, $8 million for Stuber. These were R-rated niche ideas, and for as much as everybody complains that there are no new ideas in Hollywood, and yes, you had Spider-Man Far From Home and Toy Story 4 battling it out for first and second place, you still had original movies opening last week. So the idea that Hollywood doesn't make original movies is bull. It does make original movies. It's just those movies don't tend to do as well. You know, just a throwaway original movie may or may not do terribly well. Crawl, you know what? That's going to make its money back. It had a budget of about $13 million. It's going to make its money back between this and international and video. And even Stuber. I think Stuber, that's a good old-fashioned buddy cop movie. It couldn't have been that expensive to make because these guys aren't huge stars. So, yeah, Spider-Man was still top of the box office, but that's a franchise movie. That's where something sunk hundreds of millions of dollars in and put a whole lot of advertising in. It follows the Avengers. So this Spider-Man movie's going to be fine, and we're getting ready to show that you can launch off and do more superhero movies as we go forward. And of course, this week, we're going to find out what Marvel has in store. I think there's going to be some announcements at Comic-Con, which I'll talk about next week. As for the box office this weekend, expect Lion King to totally dominate because it's the only one that's opening, and it's a big movie. It already had great preview nights on Thursday, so, I mean, I don't know if it's going to break any records, but it's still going to be a massive hit, partly for the nostalgia, partly because you're getting kind of a re-release of the original Lion King with a different look to it. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The first one I want to talk about, which is the one that's just really sort of tickling me right now, and that is Space 1999, the complete series. Shout Factory has put this together in a nice Blu-ray box set. Now, I don't really have a trailer for it, so I'm going to play the theme song, because the theme song's awesome, and we'll play that over the announcement of the trailer, and here it goes. The scientists of Moonbase Alpha are forced to become explorers when an explosion sends the moon careening out of its orbit and hurtling through space. That's right. Feel the beat. Yeah, this disco opening is kind of amazing because that's not at all what the show's like. What's neat about Space 1999 is it came out about halfway between Star Trek and Star Wars. And it was trying to be, I think, a British version of Star Trek, where they're going where no man has gone before, and they're exploring things, and they're checking out the world beyond this. I mean, it's an absurd idea that the spaceship they're on is technically the moon. Somehow there's a nuclear explosion that sends them off. It's covered in the first episode, but it still doesn't make any sense. But somehow they break out of the orbit of the Earth and then break out of the orbit of the Sun, and they're flying through space. It doesn't make a whole lot of scientific sense, but it gives them that exploratory ability. And it's more British, so it sort of has the delivery and the pacing of something more like The Prisoner than Star Trek. Star Trek was very Americanized. And of course, by the time you get to Star Wars, which I think is 6 years after Space 1999 debuted in the early 70s, That became the adventure in space. This is less of an adventure, and it's trying to be the more cerebral element, which is what Star Trek was. It also is very steeped in the 70s with its design and its delivery and some of its sensibilities. But on the Blu-ray, it looks gorgeous, first of all. I remember watching Space 1999 as a kid in the 70s on that, you know, 17-inch TV from the other side of the room that was black and white. And this thing is high def. I mean, it's not widescreen because they didn't shoot it widescreen, but you get a crisp picture. The colors are gorgeous. The effects are actually incredibly impressive when you realize that these were TV effects in the early 70s. Now, this box set has both seasons on it, season one and season two, and they have all the episodes. And buried within there, there's a bunch of special features like commentaries on the episodes and some special features here and there throughout. But there's an entire extra disc of special features, which is one of the reasons why you get something like this, because it's a classic. And in this special feature disc, this new one, you've got a bunch of new stuff in there, which is, again, pretty impressive for a series that's almost 50 years old. They've got a new interview with Barbara Bain. They've got an interview with other actors and directors. So there's plenty of new content, but there's also all the vintage stuff from previous releases that they've got, which includes interviews and promotional materials and featurettes. It is loaded with extra content. And one of the reasons why these are such good buys, these kind of box set, well done end-to-end productions, is you're not just getting the show. If you love the show, that's great, but you get the show, but then you can go back and mine all that material. And whatever the running time is, the show, you get that much more extra out of it because you can watch interviews and commentaries and get more and learn more about the series. And it is a slow burn. They are slower, more deliberate episodes. And they predate stuff like Buck Rogers or Battlestar Galactica when things get a little bit goofy and pop. This is a little bit more of a cerebral science fiction. And yeah, some of the effects and the makeup looks silly. But these are great little episodes. They're slow burns, but they're fantastic speculative science fiction from the early 70s. So I'm going to have to say Space 1999, the complete series, totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's do the next Blu-ray review, which just came out this week, and that is Shazam! Foster kid Billy Batson is given magical superpowers by a wizard in order to fight an evil scientist.
Billy Batson, I choose you as a champion. Say my name so my powers may flow through you.
But I don't know your name, sir.
Shazam.
Shazam?
This means Billy!
What is happening?
You're the only person I know that knows anything about this Caped Crusader stuff.
What are your superpowers?
Superpowers, dude? I don't even know how to pee in this thing.
Shazam has gone through so many iterations over the years because it was originally Captain Marvel, and then it got sued by DC Comics way back in the Fawcett publishing era back in the 40s, and they had to change the name. They used Captain Marvel in the books, but they had to call the book Shazam, but they finally got rid of Captain Marvel completely, which is good because there's a Captain Marvel that's rocking the box office and totally taking control of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So they just went to Shazam. This is a modern version of Shazam. So if you go back to the original Shazam, the Captain Marvel character and Billy Batson were kind of had separate memories. They weren't the same person. This one has Shazam being the same person. It's played by Zachary Levi as the adult, but he's essentially a, you know, 12, 13-year-old kid in this adult body. And it's an interesting introduction to Shazam, and it also brings in the other characters from the Shazam comics that go all the way back to the Fawcett era with Freddie Freeman and Mary Batson. They've brought all these in the way they work in the new version in the comics. And this is a fun movie. It's also along the side with Aquaman as being an entertaining, fun ride, as opposed to being dark and heavy and grim constantly, which is what we were getting with the Zack Snyder elements of Man of Steel and Batman versus Superman and even the Justice League, the parts that he contributed to that. Now, the Blu-ray, it's not loaded with special features, but it has a decent amount. It's got a motion comic in there, which those are interesting. They're not fantastic. I'm not a huge fan of motion comics, but there's some behind the scenes background and looking at some of the actors and the Shazam-y values that they have for Billy and his foster siblings. And it's also got some deleted scenes and a gag reel. So it's not totally loaded, but it still has some fun stuff in there. But ultimately, Shazam is a fun movie. And I'm glad to see the DC universe getting a goose in terms of more innovative, different, and not so drawn out, morose characters like we've been seeing in the past. So I'm going to have to say Shazam, the Blu-ray and the movie, totally rock.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Other releases this week on Blu-ray and DVD include Teen Spirit. And that's it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And until then, have a fat time at the movies.